The Spectator podcast is brought to you by Berry Brothers and Rudd.
Hello and welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Laura Prendergast, and on this week's episode, we'll be going head-to-head on some thorny issues. First, whether the young royals are devaluing the monarchy by opening up too much to us. Then, we'll be looking at whether wind power can help us out of the fossil fuel fix. And finally, we'll be discussing whether Arsene Wenger has a future in North London. On to our first item, the royals. In this week's issue, Freddie Gray says that the royal family has become Britain's biggest reality TV show. Freddie joins me now, along with the Telegraph columnist Brian Gordon, author of Mad Girl. So, Freddie, what's going on with the young royals?
I think there's always a danger for royals that they can sort of get sucked into celebrity world, because royals have to walk a very fine, delicate balance between being sort of accessible and available and visible to the public and being a bit embarrassing. And I think there's a grave danger at the moment with the younger Windsors, who are having to sort of step up, particularly with Prince Philip stepping down and the Queen is not going to carry on being quite so active for so long, that they're becoming a little bit embarrassing. They're becoming a little bit too involved in celebrity world, and they don't have a sense that their positive PR, while it may feel very good, actually a lot of people are a little bit put off by it.
Bridie, what do you make of this foray into the celebrity world?
I just don't think they've made a foray into celebrity world. I think Prince William did one, like, 3-minute video with Lady Gaga, and in your piece you say that because Prince Harry is going out with a celebrity, quote-unquote, she's an actress. But otherwise, I thought your piece was a beautifully written, exquisitely written piece of cobswallop.
Very good.
I mean, you are a great writer.
I agree with the second part.
And I appreciate as a journalist. And no, but it's not codswallop. That's unfair, because it is what a lot of people think. And a lot of people, I especially get it, you know, writing for The Telegraph, you think, oh, come on, stiff upper lip. Why are you boring us with your travails and, you know, your tales of your woes? And, you know, we just got on with it. And, you know, you say in the piece, so I've got some notes here, you say, you know, mental health is all the rage at the moment. Well, we've always all had mental health. Don't tell me that during the war, people weren't pretty miserable about what was going on. We just didn't talk about it. You know, it was illegal to commit suicide in this country until 1961. I don't know how they policed that exactly. But, you know, my feeling very much, having done the interview with Prince Harry, and obviously I'm going to defend it.
Yeah, naturally.
But I thought that it was, as we are now in this room, it was actually not quite as nice a room as this at Kensington Palace, I have to say. The Spectator offices are nicer than some of the rooms at Kensington Palace. Have that for the record. But it was, you know, it was two people chatting, and he didn't want to be, you know, he said, no sad music. I don't want this to be that. It wasn't, you know, woe is me. It was people, it was him sort of talking about the things he'd gone through, which I don't think were entirely
I think that's where I have a slight problem, in that the whole message behind the Heads Together campaign was, yeah, it's not about us. We're just, you know, trying to develop a mechanism or something by which we can encourage other people to talk. But that's just disingenuous, really, because it is about them.
But it wasn't about, it was, to be fair, it wasn't about them. So it launched back in May, and, you know, they've kept off. But obviously, you know, as a journalist, there was going to be a point where one of them was going to have to turn around and talk.
Yeah.
And it just so happened that Prince Harry chose to do it with me. Now, I thought he did it in a very, you know, upbeat kind of way. And I don't think that it's...
But I thought, actually, in your piece, he did actually talk, which was why your piece was rather more sort of engaging than a lot of the sort of spiel that came afterwards. Because in a lot of, there was two videos that Heads Together produced with the royals, in which they sort of danced around mental health, saying the word mental health, saying how good it was to talk, and sort of inferring that they'd had things but never actually talking about themselves. So I could see that they were awkward talking about themselves, but they were still sort of talking about themselves without talking about themselves. And it was a little bit cringe-making. And it was a lot, which is what I'm trying to say in the piece, it was a lot like a scene from an episode in Made in Chelsea, which I haven't watched that much, but I've watched a bit. And it is just not terribly bright. They're very nice, but not terribly bright people sitting around having quite inane conversations that sort of seem to have meaning. I found it a bit cringe-making. And I don't really think monarchy, if you believe in monarchy, you don't want it to be cringe-making. You don't want it to be embarrassing.
Okay, so here's my thing. Obviously, you refer to the Queen saying that, you know, all of this kind of emotional telling and, you know, spilling your guts out is not what we do in Buckingham Palace. That's apparent. I don't know if that's true. The public duty of the monarch when, you know, back in the, you know, during war and post-war, was to keep a dignified, you know, stiff upper lip and hold it together. And that was when the biggest killer of young men in this country was the Nazis, right? Today, the biggest killer of young men is suicide in this country. And the highest risk category of people at risk of suicide are men aged between 45 and 59 years. But your readers, you know, people listening to this podcast right now. So I would say that actually it's totally been an act of public duty what they've been doing with Heads Together. Now, you may not like how they've done it, you may not like the videos, but I definitely think that when I know from when I was 12 and when I was really ill, if three members of, frankly, the most dysfunctional family on the planet were talking about mental health, how different the trajectory of my recovery could have been. Because people are talking about it now, and they are talking about it. And the important thing is we don't get bogged down in this. I found it a bit cringeworthy and embarrassing. And we move on and go, right, what are we going to do with it? What are we going to do about it? How are we going to get all the major parties to kind of commit properly to it?
There's this idea that the monarchy needs to move on. But, I mean, the Queen has done a pretty good job at kind of keeping things stable. Do you think they do need to adapt and move on?
I think they're just slowly doing it. I think we all love the Queen, don't we?
But well, I spoke to some sort of royal sources that who were very keen on stressing that the younger royals were showing that they could adapt the monarchy for the 21st century, for the digital age, because this was a very social media savvy campaign. But I think that's probably what the royals thought when they did It's a Royal Knockabout in 1987. And I think they too probably thought at the time, this is great, we're engaging with a different audience.
We're showing that we're not stiff. You
cannot
compare a silly ITV show, was it ITV, I can't remember, with a massive campaign to change the conversation
I'm afraid it was a massive campaign. It raised, you know, 1.5 million for the Samaritans. Also, I mean, are you saying that's not an important charity?
It is important. That is important. I didn't know that, though. So it wasn't successful as a campaign, was it? Because I didn't know. Is that what Ritz and Royal Lockout was for?
Yes, they were all sponsored by a different charity.
So who cares that they made tits out of themselves? Brilliant them. And I
because I think because a lot of people who follow the royal family quite closely think that this is the time when the royals started to make the monarchy about them and about their performance, not just their performance but also emoting. And that's where the monarchy went very badly wrong in the 80s and 90s, was that it became about emoting and about speaking about their feelings. And although people do respond to that and they do engage with it, ultimately it undermines the monarchy and it makes people dislike
why?
It.
Do royals not have feelings? Are they robots?
No, they absolutely
do
not.
I will argue, as Prince Harry said to me, he said, I think probably people were like shock, you know, Major Royal speaks about his mental health issues. I don't think it was really a shock to any of us that a man who was made to walk behind his mother's coffin at the age of 12 after, you know, quite an acrimonious divorce between his parents and then, you know, gone on to serve in Afghanistan, that he had a mental health issue. I certainly wasn't surprised when he said to me that he'd had issues. You know, I think the idea that the royals don't talk, you know, then they keep up this public appearance of, I just think it's changed. I think the world has changed. I think there have long been mental health issues. We talk now about there being an epidemic of anxiety and depression. I don't think more people today are depressed than they were 50 years ago. I think we're just talking about it more. And that's a good thing. Because if you don't talk about it, nothing happens. There is no one has ever got better from a mental illness from not talking about it. And we've got to now, and sorry, I know you're desperate to talk.
No.
Mental health covers everything from anxiety through to, say, schizophrenia, in much the same way physical health covers everything through from the common cold to cancer. And if you don't treat these things early on, they snowball. And it's a no-brainer on every single level for us to invest and talk about mental health more, because poor mental health results in antisocial behaviour, it results in addiction, alcoholism, criminal behaviour. You know, you can cut this off the source and the world just becomes a better place to live on. It isn't about us all going, I feel this way and I feel that way. I don't sit around crying and telling everyone my feelings the whole time, except when I'm writing books about it. Do you know what I mean? But the point is to say it's people like me, people like Prince Harry, people like maybe you, Freddie, maybe you've had mental health issues. You probably know someone.
I think I might do soon.
But I'm just saying, I just think it's the most important thing.
Sorry, but I mean, I do see your point there completely, and I really don't want to be sort of flippant about mental health at all. But what I do want to say is that I think that the monarchy is slightly risking its status in a way, because I think we used to live in a stiff upper lip culture, and that was an aristocratic and stiff and rather horrid culture. It was also a very royalist culture in Britain. And now we live in a celebrity culture. And in fact, monarchy has been relegated behind celebrity.
And usurped.
Usurped, exactly. And I think that now the royals are having to play a celebrity game, But actually, is it a good idea? I don't think it is.
I mean, with celebrity culture, people are very used to voting off people that they don't like from programmes. I mean, isn't it a slightly risky game that the royals are now playing?
So we're going to put them all in the big, we're going to turn Buckingham Palace into the Big
Brother
house.
People are used to turning against celebrities.
I just don't think, you know, if you look at their next, I don't have their diary in front of me, but I know their next engagements for the foreseeable future have nothing to do with Heads Together, and they're hosting, I mean, we had the story this weekend about how Prince Harry was going to host his first garden party this next month. They're all proper royal duties. They took 1 week, it was a One week running up to the London Marathon, where they had this huge amount of publicity.
Doesn't that just show it's all sort of PR?
But it wasn't PR because they didn't. I think the point was they wanted to get as much. I think they did want to make it as much about other people and get all these other charities involved. But the point is that the very fact that they say these things or they address this makes it more easy for you or me or whoever's walking outside the window right now to kind of go, okay, actually, he's talking about it. I can go and talk about it.
Let's just quickly move on to privacy, because this is another thing you address in your piece, Freddie. Because you say they're sort of trying to have it two ways. On the one hand, they're suing the press for intrusion. On the same time, they're talking about their own mental health. Do you think that's in itself quite risky?
Royals always do this, I think, of sort of trying to have their privacy cake and eat it too. But I think there's something particularly obnoxious about the way the younger royals have started to do it, in that when they want to say to the press, so in November, Prince Harry was upset, understandably, that his girlfriend had been harassed. And so they wanted to tell the media that this was really not on. They wanted to release a statement, and they could have released a short statement about it. But instead, it was a sort of rather pompous 800-word piece about, you know, how Harry feels, how he's tried to develop a thick skin. And it was actually in itself a PR stunt. It was designed to generate, maybe I'm horribly cynical, but for me, I thought it was.
I think you are quite cynical.
But it was designed to generate headlines. I mean, obviously, it was also designed to make Harry feel better, but it was also designed to generate headlines, which it did.
She's my girlfriend now. Can we not harass her? I think that was what it. That's how I read it. But maybe I'm not cynical enough.
Do you think we should be cynical about the royals?
I don't know why. I don't think there's anything. I think it's genuine. I hate the word authentic because it sounds so fake, doesn't it? But having met them, they are... I sound like a simpering royalist saying this, but they are really nice guys and they're completely normal. And when I was sitting on the sofa talking to Harry, it was like chatting. I mean, we're not mates. I'm not going to be one of those people that pretends, you know, like, oh, now I've spoken to a royal once. We're best friends and we go around to each other for dinner parties. But I really think they connect with people. I don't think it's all contrived. I think it's just they're trying to do their best with what they've got. And to use that position, and I know it sounds twee and I know it sounds, you know, corny, but to use their position, a lot of people will have been helped. And it's not all the rage to talk about your mental health and admit to anxiety and depression. Anyone who's suffered from depression will tell you that they would do anything to give it, to not have had it. And ditto, I imagine William and Harry would give back all of their privilege, all of their, you know, wealth to have their mum back, or to at least have been able to say goodbye to her. And I think that what they've done is they've said, right, we're in this position, we've got to talk about something, we've got to kind of get behind something, that's our royal duty, we're going to get behind mental health because it's something that's affected our families, our friends, we know it affects one in four of us. And I don't think that's cringeworthy. I think at the end of the day, I don't know, I hate saying at the end of the day, but I think ultimately the production values of 2-3 minute videos that went out during the week lead up to the marathon are not important. And what's important is a national conversation has been started about mental health.
That was Freddie Gray and Bryony Gordon. And Freddie also hosts our Americano podcast, which you can subscribe to on iTunes.
If you've always wanted to start a wine cellar, 2017 could be the perfect time. Barry Brothers and Rudd's cellar plan is designed to suit all tastes and budgets. To find out more, visit bbr.com/cellar plan.
On to our second topic, wind power. You may have got the impression that wind power is making a big contribution to world energy today, but you would be wrong, says Matt Ridley in this week's issue of The Spectator. Its contribution is still trivial to the point of irrelevance. I'm now joined by Matt Ridley and Leo Murray, Director of Strategy for Climate Change Campaign Group 1010. So Matt, we see pictures of wind turbines everywhere. Are they really not making a big contribution?
Less than 0.5% of world total energy supply at the moment. Oh, that's 2014. The latest numbers has gone up a tiny bit since then. So it's approaching 0.5%. That's really tiny when you consider how many turbines have been installed and how much they, how prominent they are in every photograph you ever see in the media or in adverts in newspapers or anything, or in airports or whatever. You know, you simply get the impression that this is the bulk of the renewables. In fact, the renewables are mostly wood, hydro, and a few other things.
Why is it that we see them so much then? Is it a good lobbying from the wind?
They're iconic, they're visible, and they've had a huge amount of subsidy in this country. And my point is really that you know, if you are serious about climate change, I'm not very, you know, I mean, I'm not as worried about it as some people, but if you are, then, you know, this is not going to solve the problem because they take an awful lot of space. They have very low density energy, and so you need a lot of acreage. And they're actually a distraction because in some parts of the world where they are beginning to make a significant contribution, they've actually made it difficult for nuclear to stay open because when the wind's blowing, nuclear has to go off grid and that's expensive for it.
Leah, you're quite clearly serious about climate change. Do you agree with Matt that wind turbines aren't really contributing?
No. I mean, I think certainly there are some facts in Matt's piece, but what he's done here is he's chosen selective and partial set of facts to draw conclusions which are at odds with the conclusions of not just academics, engineers and scientists, but a multi-billion dollar global industry. So, you know, that shouldn't inspire confidence in the analysis amongst your readers. There's lots of things that Matt just said that I could pick up on there, but one of his key starting points here is that primary energy supply, wind, makes up less than 1% of that globally. Now, this was true in 2014, as you said, they're 2014 figures, but primary energy supply is not a helpful metric here because it measures all of the energy which we consume. Now, that's not all useful energy. That includes approximately two-thirds of fossil energy, which is expressed as waste heat. It's not useful energy to us. A more sensible metric to use would be final energy demand, which, you know, if you look in BP statistical review, you see that wind makes up about 1.4% in 2015, about 1.4% of that. Now, that's useful energy which we use. So you've picked the wrong metric to start with.
I said supply. I meant consumption. This is actually percentage of consumption, according to the IEA, the International Energy Agency.
I'm sorry.
Well, that's where I got the numbers from.
Yes, I'm familiar with the IEA report you're talking about.
The key renewables trends from the IEA.
Yes, but the IEA figures include all of the energy that is consumed, not the energy which we actually use. It's, you know, I think, unfortunately, you're not understanding the figures that you're using here.
No, I do. No, I understand the point you're making, but it's not. But I was wrong to say it's supply. It's not the supply issue. It's the consumption. It is consumed. You say some of that is consumed wastefully. Sure, I don't disagree with that. But the same is true of wind, of course, because enormous constraint payments are paid to wind turbine producers in this country to not produce wind when the wind's blowing too strongly.
So look, I need to pick up on, you know, can wind make an appreciable difference? You know, it can wind contribute significantly to meeting our energy demand and to decarbonisation targets? And the answer to that is absolutely yes, it can and it does. So, you know, the
useful
metric
here... But it can only do
metric
0.5% or 1.5%, whichever it is. That's the most...
It's starting from a very low
base.
And
it's going to be less than that.
I'm not disputing
that. And it's going to be less than that, remember, because you have to have backup. So, and the backup is usually fossil fuels. It has to be gas because that's the flexible one. So, in effect, it can't even reach that 1.5%.
For the avoidance of doubt, for people who are listening, in the UK, wind energy, that's onshore and offshore, is currently meeting close to 12% of our electricity demand.
Electricity, that's not the same as energy.
Wind turbines do not generate heat or fuel for transport.
Exactly, and that's a problem. Because,
well, you're complaining that wind turbines don't meet our demand for bananas. They don't make bananas. They make electricity.
82% of our energy is in globally is actually not used for electricity.
Yes,
it's
in
used
the UK,
for
that
transport
is a smaller
and heat
proportion.
And all that.
Yes, absolutely.
And that has got to be decarbonised too if you're going to make a difference.
It does.
And remember, the plan is that we are going to heat our homes with electricity instead of gas, etc., etc. We're going to try and decarbonise transport and heat as well.
So wind has got to
make a contribution.
So let's be clear,
the right number is not the percentage of electricity, it's the percentage of energy.
In the UK, the Committee on Climate Change and others state very clearly that offshore wind alone, that single technology, there is enough resource in the UK's offshore wind to meet well in excess of 100% of our electricity demand, even after factoring in significant decarbonisation of heat and transport. So in the future, just that one technology. Now, the reality is no one is proposing that we're going to use a single technology to meet all of our electricity demands. You know, we can get to a fully renewable future with no fossil fuels in it, and actually no nuclear, that's a separate question, by a combination of different energy sources, of which wind is going to be a significant contributor.
Of course.
Think solar, tidal, geothermal, wave, you know, all of these things will make up, in total, they'll meet our energy demand.
Add solar, tidal and wind together, you still don't get to 1% of world energy consumption at the moment. And remember, it takes 150 tonnes of coal to make a wind turbine. On average, around the world, because you need the coal to make the steel, you need it to provide the carbon for the steel, you also need it to make the cement for the base. And so 150 tonnes of coal is quite a lot of coal. So actually, you're having to burn quite a lot of coal even to build these things. And you're going to need 350,000 turbines a year compared with the 7,000 we've got in the UK.
In order to
keep up just with the increase in the demand for energy in the world, not to actually erode fossil fuel share.
Okay, let's just deal with the carbon footprint of wind energy. I appreciate that you have done some calculations on a napkin in your kitchen, and
they're not on a napkin in my kitchen. They're from reputable sources.
Well, let me tell you that multiple peer-reviewed studies show that, yes, I'm not disputing that there is coal involved in producing the steel that you need to use for wind turbines. Wind turbines repay their carbon costs in 3 to 6 months. And then we're talking about the 2 megawatt wind turbines that you've chosen
I didn't make that point. That wasn't the point I made. It was a different point. I just said 150 tonnes per turbine. It's quite a lot of coal.
So, yes,
it means that if we were to build 300,000 turbines, we'd need more coal than the whole of Europe is producing.
This is a great example of where you take a fact and then you use that to draw conclusions that...
That's called journalism. You take a fact and use it to draw conclusions.
Yes, but they don't match the conclusions which have been reached by other people.
Yeah, well, but you see, one of my points here is that there is a very powerful wind energy lobby, and it is extremely influential, and it is extremely naughty with the way it uses data, I think. And I think it's time someone stood up to it, because actually it's wholly dependent on subsidy. It keeps saying it no longer is dependent on subsidy. Fine, call it bluff, cancel the subsidies, and see whether it could survive.
Okay, so let's talk about that. So, you know, one of the things that I think is interesting as an omission from your piece is it doesn't feature in there, but you've spoken a lot about it in the past, is cost. You know, that the cost of wind energy is very high. Now, the reality is that today in the UK and many other markets around the world, the cheapest source of new electricity generating capacity, bar none, not just cheapest low carbon, but bar none, cheaper than gas, is onshore wind.
I don't agree with you. The last round of contracts for difference, the lowest price was £80 a megawatt hour, whereas at the moment the wholesale price of electricity is £40 a megawatt hour. That's twice. So it's not the cheapest.
It's not.
Should we talk about other options right now? Because at the end of your piece, Matt, you do go on to talking about what you would like to see in place of wind. What would you prefer to be seeing promoted?
Well, I think if we're going to solve this problem of climate change, then of decarbonisation, if you like, then the answer's got to be nuclear in the long run, because that's the only technology on any scale that can solve this problem. But nuclear is not ready at the moment because it's too expensive. It simply cannot compete on cost, partly because renewables are undermining its economics at the moment. So the obvious thing to do is to do the bridge to gas in the first place, and gas is a much lower carbon fuel than coal, and is much cleaner as well in every other way, much less polluting, much less dangerous. So, you know, to convert as much of the world's energy supply to gas in the short term would be cheap and quick, and would give us several decades in which to sort out the problem of how to get nuclear fission or fusion lower. And to do that, we've got to pump money into research. You know, we should be researching energy technologies, not rolling out 14th century technologies like wind power.
Let's just talk about gas for a moment. Yes, switching from coal to gas, that produces some big emission savings. And we've done that in the UK. So in a UK context,
what you're saying is
very misleading. You know, coal is nearly off our system. We've had some full days with no coal.
Well,
you know,
that's not quite true, because, of course, we've used coal in industry during that period.
Yes, but coal's going to drop off.
There's no coal.
coal's going to drop off the grid, you know, in a handful of years' time. And calculations by UK Energy Research Council show that countries like Britain that already have a high proportion of gas generation, by 2050, when we have to meet our climate change targets, gas generation of power needs to be at about 10% of what it is today. So there's no benefit to be derived for a country like the UK from switching to gas. We effectively already did a dash to gas.
But there's a big benefit in the rest of the world, and we could be supporting that in, for example, India and China, where we're not. We're refusing to support gas-powered power. We're instead trying to support wind and solar.
So let's talk about nuclear for a moment, because I know, you know, you're a fan of nuclear, and you finished your last point about wind complaining about subsidies. Now, wind energy is on a trajectory to zero subsidies. And when I say on a trajectory, in the real world, there are at least three large wind turbines being constructed right now in Europe and Morocco without any public subsidy.
Without subsidy for their connection or their system costs?
Let's just be clear there, Matt.
Hang on, you've got to include the system cost subsidy and the connection cost subsidy.
Nuclear
power, that is an important part that's always left out of that.
Nuclear power today costs the same in real terms as it did 50 years ago.
I quite agree. Costs are going nowhere. It's ridiculously expensive, and that's because of safety concerns, which have led us to over-engineer nuclear power stations. And
so they should be less safe, is your...
They should be even safer, but with more
cheaply.
Yes, and it can be done, absolutely.
There is no business model. So let's just be clear. Markets do not build nuclear power plants.
Agreed.
Governments build nuclear power plants.
Agreed.
And all of the nuclear power plants, which are all the projects which are live around the world at the moment, are massively over schedule and over budget.
I agree with that.
So suggesting that nuclear is a solution...
But that's why I'm not saying it's the solution now. I'm saying we've got to work out how to make it cheaper.
Wind and solar are working. They're succeeding. You know, you're invoking the need for a solution.
Half a percent of world energy.
We're talking about a UK context.
No, I'm talking about the world. The world, it's a global problem, climate change. It's not a UK... You can't have UK climate change controlled by UK energy policy.
No, but decisions here... They affect what happens here. And that's what, you know, the people who read The Spectator and read your piece will be,
I'm allowed to write for the world, aren't I? I thought I had a global audience.
No, we have a global audience.
So what you're saying is you'd be very happy that wind can make a significant contribution to the UK's decarbonisation efforts, and that we can, you're comfortable with the idea that we could meet most of our electricity demand
wind here. No, I don't think we could meet most of our, because we've got to have backup, we've got to have the problem of non-windy days. And as David Mackay, who was chief scientist at the Department of Energy and Climate Change, made the point, wind is simply too low density, and therefore you need an enormous acreage of wind farms to produce significant quantities of electricity. We've got however many we've got, a few thousand on land, and they've ruined my own home county of Northumberland in terms of landscape and amenity. They've put cement bases into deep peat. They're killing birds on an industrial scale. Do you know the ravens in the Lammermuir Hills now go to the wind farms in order to find things to eat, dead birds? You know, they are not a clean technology. And don't forget that the magnets in them are made with rare earth metals mined in Inner Mongolia in an extremely dirty process. That is something that's out of sight and out of mind.
One more point, Leo, and then we have to finish.
Well, I guess, you know, there's no such thing as a free lunch. All sources of energy have environmental impacts.
Agreed.
And, you know, it's specious. Studies show that fossil generation kills 15 times as many birds per unit of energy generated as wind.
No, that's not true. It's about 100 times less. It is true. And the data's been gathered. The one thing
in your piece where you know, I share some of your concerns is around the mining of rare earth metals. But that is not a problem which is caused by wind, and stopping wind generation would not solve it. It's a problem for all consumer electronics.
Quite a big part of their market.
It's a problem for everything, and it's actually fundamentally it's a consequence of China cornering the market with very lax environmental regulations. You know, it's possible to mine with less environmental damage.
That was Matt Ridley and Leo Murray.
Hello, I'm Sam Leith, literary editor of The Spectator, and I present the weekly books podcast, at which you'll hear lively discussions from the best and most interesting critics and writers and authors out there, from Charlotte Rampling to Daniel Dennett, all the way past to Michael Morpurgo. I very much hope you'll give us a try. Just search for Spectator Books on the iTunes store.
Finally, on to football.
There's a growing movement at Arsenal to oust the team's manager, Arsene Wenger. But as Damian Riley says in this week's issue, if the fans are so annoyed, why don't they leave the club? I'm now joined by Damian and Ollie Duff, the editor of the IA newspaper. So you're both Arsenal fans. Damian, you think Arsene should stay. Ollie, you think he should go. What's your case, Damian?
My case is that he has been a terrific servant to the club for a very long time and is still achieving at a very, very high level. He's not winning. He hasn't won the league for 13 years, which is what the source of all the angst is about. If he had won the league in the last 13 years, this whole debate wouldn't be happening. If he'd won it, say, 5 years ago or 6 years ago, everything would be fine. But he hasn't, and people get very angry. However, it's worth pointing out that Liverpool haven't won it for 27 years, Tottenham haven't won it since 1960, and Newcastle haven't won it for 90 years. So I think these things are relative, and I think maybe some of the more strident Wenger out voices have lost sight of that.
Nolly, what's your case?
Well, first of all, if I could just say this is like therapy, it's wonderful. I love Arsene Wenger. You know, I've supported Arsenal for 24 years. I've defended him for the past 9 years. I'm not a social media monster here, but he took the team I love from mediocrity, from mid-table, from being boring Arsenal, where half the squad were on booze or coke and, you know, some of the others were in prison, to being this synonymous with glory and style, you know, international renown. But although I think history will judge him magnificently, we've been stagnating for a decade and I just can't take any more. It's like Groundhog Day. Please go, Arsene. I know you listen to the Spectator's podcast. It's heartbreaking to see you damage your legacy. I think things probably won't get any better if he goes, but they'll be different at least.
When you say stagnating, I mean, they're about to reach the FA Cup final.
They came second in the league last year.
Yeah, and they're not, I mean...
They did, but what's been happening really is they've never been in competition for these biggest trophies, you know, the Premier League, the Champions League. They never looked like getting out of the starting blocks with any conviction. For the best part of a decade now, I mean, they had a go at it in about 2008. But ever since then, it's been a tale of drifting backwards. And last year, I mean, it was delightful finishing ahead of Tottenham, but that was about the limit of it.
They won the FA Cup as well.
Yeah.
Is this partly to do with Tottenham? Because this is going to be the first season for a long time that Tottenham finish above Arsenal. Is that why it's reached a crescendo this season?
It absolutely is. And I realised last year that I'm quite a bad human being. I mean, it's taken 34 years. But it was when we got to the end of the season and I took such joy in the downfalls of our rivals Tottenham, ahead of us in contention for the league title before choking and finishing third in the two-horse race. In all seriousness, that was my footballing highlight of the year and it brought happiness to my life. Supporting Arsenal is just one of the many ways in which I express my self-hatred.
Ollie, what would you want? I mean, if Arsenal got a new manager, what would you want them to do differently?
It's not success at all costs. You don't want someone to come in and play pretty ugly football. You know, I mean, the point Damian makes in this week's Spectator about style is absolutely critical, and beauty, you know. So for that reason, someone like Diego Simeone from Atletico Madrid probably wouldn't go down too well. It might be a little bit agricultural. So you do want them to play with a certain style, but you want to see that desire and will to win that was missing from so many performances this season that are utterly anemic. You know, you look at Arsene Wenger now, and there is a broader question which is relevant in many fields of life. You know, how do people who are great at what they do stay that way? How do they innovate? How do they stay at the top? When success so often breeds complacency, you know, he is a great man, but he's been overtaken by time. It's clear he doesn't have the capacity to reinvent himself or his side. He refuses to create tactical plans around the opposition. You know, this looks like a relic of some sort of jolly bygone era, like bowler hats or Morris dancing. And a quote he gave yesterday tells it for me. I cannot change myself now. I am who I am. That is it. Now, regardless of what age you are, and he's 67, you can't take that attitude in any elite pursuit. You constantly have to adapt and evolve to stay successful. If you compare that with Sir Alex Ferguson, who carried on winning titles until his last year at Manchester United when he retired, he says, complacency is a disease. The questions going through my mind during any celebration were, how do we top this? So you want to see that sort of hunger come back.
Damien, I live quite near the Arsenal Stadium and I've always been quite struck by how sort of friendly all the fans seem. But you say in your piece that you think they're quite brutish. Is that online or is that...
Online there's certainly some fairly unpleasant stuff being said. I'm not calling the Arsenal fans unpleasant in any way. I'm saying that this desire to get Wenger out has maybe tipped over into some unpleasantness. So I think there's been some fighting in the stands between Arsenal fans, Wenger in and Wenger out. I think somebody paid to have an airplane flown over the stadium bearing the trail of Wenger out, which seemed pretty rude.
Jeremy Corbyn had to come to his defence yesterday because people were holding up Wenger out.
Yeah, they're being held up all over the place. I mean, everyone understands the anger, I suppose, but I think it's misplaced and has become unpleasant.
Do you think it's partly to do with the internet?
Because before people would have gone to a game and watched it and that would have been it. But now there's this constant, and especially these big celebrities who seem to be whipping up.
This sort of dissent, yes, it can be accelerated by social media. You'll have seen the Wenger Out banners around the world, you know, New Zealand, Fiji, Kenya, ringside at the American Wrestling, you know, a Coldplay concert in Singapore. It even made it into that infamous Pepsi ad recently. But we're not talking about these people here, really. You know, the dismay is genuine, I think. It's not confected for a narcissistic audience on social media. It's been building among fans in the ground for about a decade now.
Tottenham's had lots of managers and is looking like it's going to do quite well this season. Do you think that's the solution to have...
A quick, fast turnover
of managers?
I think there is no silver bullet or secret. I think it's terrifically hard to win the Football League, I mean, to win the league or to win a cup. And I think what Arsenal were given a decade ago was, in a short period of time, they won it three times. And the feeling is now it should always be this way. But it doesn't work that way, I think. And the examples I gave earlier about Newcastle not having won it for 90 years or Tottenham since 1960, it is incredibly hard. So 13 years, although it is very painful for Arsenal fans, isn't actually that long.
There is a point about wider corporate culture here, I think, and that's failure of succession planning. If you look at Arsenal, one of the great heritage clubs of English football, now run as just another sporting franchise. And it's that lack of desire and passion from within the club that I think fans really feel and they really dislike. You have a silent, indifferent owner who lives abroad. You've got a missing chief executive. You know, a club entirely built around one man without any sort of succession plan for when he goes. He's become unaccountable, and that's really healthy for any executive. I saw in your article, Damien, you mentioned Heinz baked beans and saying if Heinz changed the recipe and you no longer liked it, you'd buy another brand of beans. Why doesn't football work this way? If Heinz baked beans started smelling of fish, I think the factory manager would get fired, and that's the problem at Arsenal.
Well, my point is rather different. So a lot of Arsenal fans can't stand the management, can't stand the staff, which are the players, can't stand the new premises, and can't stand the product. If you can't stand any of those things about an institution or a shop or a restaurant or whatever it is, why would you continue to patronise it? The problem for football fans is they will never leave. They are sort of madly loyal, but the point is, to what are they loyal? And can you really call yourself a supporter if you hate everything about the team?
No, I take that. I mean, I think you look at the situation now and you think that there's some pretty terrible leadership from the board. I think most fans have a huge affection for Arsene Wenger. And I agree with you. I think Arsenal should build a 100-metre-high statue of Arsene outside the ground, preferably so it can be seen from Tottenham. And then they should point him to his new seat upstairs in the director's box, where he would add a great deal of expertise to the board, who are currently showing terrible leadership. They appear terrified of instigating change, which is awful in any organisation. They're going to let it happen to them, which is the coward's approach to destiny.
Well, we don't know that. We don't know that for sure. And Arsenal came second last year, third the year before, and won the FA Cup. Last week beat Man City. The week before that beat Manchester United, or the other way around. You know, things aren't as bad. There are a lot of Arsenal fans who are now desperate for them to lose, so that their argument for Wenger out is strengthened. Hmm. And that's a sort of mad position.
Do you think there are lots of people who want them to lose the FA Cup?
I don't.
Just so that they can
lose games. No, they want them to lose.
I don't know any personally. There are plenty of people online who you can find like that.
There are people who, every time they do win, downplay the victory. They'll say, oh, Manchester United fielded a weakened team, or the FA Cup's no longer a relevant competition, which is ridiculous.
You have to take joy, don't you? Otherwise, why are you there?
These are things to compete for. Yeah, so I think a lot of Arsenal fans should ask, what is it they enjoy about Arsenal?
Damien, you made the switch from Man United to Arsenal.
Yeah.
Ollie, do you think that slightly invalidates Damien's sort of right to kind of say that Arsenal should...
No, I don't. I think it's
Arsenal.
An unusual journey, but I don't think it invalidates that. I think clubs all the time, to be successful, you're looking to attract new fans from wherever. And in many ways, it speaks to Wenger's great success, which is to imprint a style and a philosophy on his teams, successive teams, that will attract people from other sides.
Just finally, what next season, say Arsene Wenger does stay on, what would you see as kind of validation that he should have stuck with the team?
Everything rests on
the
side.
Do they need to win the league?
No, they don't need to win the league.
Do you not think to get the fans off his back?
No, I don't think so. I think they need to show genuine fight. They need to be in the race, and that's something that we've not done for years. I think fans could live with it if it was a tight race, 2 or 3 horse race, and we faded away a few weeks from the end. But
didn't you have that last season?
Yeah, last season.
Not really, no. We were second last year, but we came through on the rails at the end, you know.
That was Damien Riley and Ollie Duff. That's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. And you can also subscribe to our other shows, including our Holy Smoke podcast, where this week, Damien Thompson, Christina Adone and Fraser Nelson discuss Britain's dwindling faith. And if you enjoy the podcast, why not pick up the magazine? You can read all the features discussed, as well as great pieces by Boris Johnson, George Osborne and Matthew Paris. And we've got a trial offer. You can get 6 issues of The Spectator for just £6 by visiting spectator.co.uk/election offer. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.